This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Myron Everton. I am in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Everton, you are in Potomac Falls, Virginia, and it is Thursday, October 31st, 2002. Sir, if we could begin with some basic biographical information. Where were you born, and when were you born?
Well, I was born in Columbia, North Carolina, in a little township called Gum Neck on September 30th, 1926.
Okay. Did you grow up there in Gum Neck?
Except for 3 years in another town in North Carolina when my family moved temporarily. Mm-hmm. I grew up right in that township until I was 16 years old and graduated from high school there.
Okay, so you basically spent all of your youth there in Gum Neck.
Mm-hmm.
What was life like for you there in Gum Neck?
Well, we're looking back now to the late 1930s and very early 1940s.
Yes, sir.
This little community I lived in still did not have electricity.
Oh, my gosh.
And no telephones.
Okay.
So I was on a farm, my dad also worked for a local lumber company down there.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, life was a little bit slow in those days compared to now.
Right.
But it was a pretty decent place to grow up.
Okay. Know. Okay. You said your dad worked for a lumber company.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And did your mom work?
My mother was just at that time a housekeeper.
Okay.
She did work when the war started. The family left and moved up to Norfolk, Virginia, and both of them took war jobs up there.
Okay.
But that was about the time I graduated from high school.
Okay. Do you have any distinct memories of the Great Depression in the 30s?
Oh, yes, quite a bit of it. Living in the country and on a farm, we were relatively self-sufficient for food mm-hmm. compared to people in the cities.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather had been fairly successful in earning a livelihood, and he helped support the family and keep them up. So we never really suffered from a lack of food or adequate clothing or anything like that. We had an automobile, and
mm-hmm.
we had an old battery-operated radio that we could keep up with the news.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of thing didn't affect us as near as much as people who lived in cities and lost
right.
their employment.
Right. Okay. Did you work in your youth?
Oh, yes. I had to help keep that farm. I could plow a straight furrow as far as the mules could pull it.
Oh, yeah? What kind of work did you do on the farm?
Looking after the livestock, feeding the cows, the work mules, the chickens,
mm-hmm.
Helping raise the crops, harvest them, corn, soybeans,
mm-hmm.
and, of course, we had big gardens, spring, fall, and summer.
Okay.
And you took your turn working at all of those to help out with it.
Right. Was that the only job you had? I mean, that's a huge job, but was that the only job you had growing up? Working?
Well, in my senior year in high school, I had just turned 16, and I was given the job of school bus driver.
Hmm.
So I was in my senior year, I was also one of the two school bus drivers that we had.
For your fellow students? Or?
Yes, hauling the fellow students.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, do you have any memories of schooling growing up, and particularly high school?
Well, I'll tell you this, Richie, the school in terms of comparison with today wasn't much.
Okay.
We had our high school had grades 9, 10, 8, 9, 10, 11. There were only four 11 grades in North Carolina in those days.
Okay.
And the we had two teachers to teach all the subjects for all four of the levels.
Okay.
And the net result was that in some courses, particularly mathematics and science, we received very little.
Okay.
We did have a pretty good teacher for French,
mm-hmm.
And the social studies and the English were done pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But our highest level of math was algebra, and the teacher really didn't understand it himself, is my best recollection.
Okay. Did you go ahead.
So anyway, when we graduated and left there, I wouldn't say that we were very well prepared to face the world compared to our kids that go out today. But, you know, you made it up as you went along. I was leaving going out in the middle of World War II, 1943 is when I graduated.
Okay.
And I enrolled down at Norfolk where my parents had moved in a night school training program to learn to be a commercial radio operator. I had some ambitions in that direction. I was interested in radio. And the mathematics were the toughest part for me, but what you essentially had to do was sit down and learn what was required to meet that course, you know. So I got my license, and that eventually led to my first service. I don't call it military service exactly, but I was in World War II as a commercial radio operator in the Merchant Marine. And eventually, in fact, was commissioned as an ensign in the United States Maritime Service. So that's... You know, it's education as you go, I guess.
Right. Well, it sounds like you took advantage of what you could. What were your favorite subjects there in school?
I was a social studies type. I was really interested in history and English to a degree. And the sciences were interesting, like earth science and that type thing. Not the sciences that required the heavy mathematics, because I simply didn't have the background. So those were the places my interest lay.
Okay. What aspects of history were you interested in?
World history and U.S. history.
Okay. Did the war play a part in your interest in history? You know, what was going on while you were there in high school?
That's quite possible. I would, let's see, at 41... I would have probably been approaching my junior year when the war started, and of course that got everyone's attention in a hurry. And but I think generally I even had the interest in, you know, in the elementary school level, studying the history of North Carolina and the history of the United States and what have you. I was sort of an avid reader. And we didn't even have a library in that little school, but we did have a room with a lot of books you could go thumb around in. And what saved the day for us in those years, we had the bookmobiles that would roll out from the county or regional library about twice a month and come through the community, and they would let you check books out. So I did a lot of reading, particularly fiction.
Do you remember any of your favorite books you read?
Oh, I like the Westerns. Zane Grey was my favorite author.
I'm familiar with Zane Grey.
Yeah.
So your folks moved to Norfolk, and did you stay there?
They moved just after the beginning of my senior year, so I stayed with my grandmother to finish my high school. And then I went down and joined them in 1943. In summer of 43.
And what kind of jobs had they taken with the military? Or support, I guess.
Yeah, they you know, Norfolk's a big Navy town. And my dad was working at the Naval Operating Base on the security force there. My mother was working, I believe, on the air station as a person that when they would pack and repair parts, they had to pack them for shipping. She was, it was a non-skilled job. She worked packing and working in the shipping department there. So that's pretty much where they stayed till the war was over.
And how different was it when you moved up there to Norfolk? How different was it for you to get out of where you had grown up there in this very small community?
Well, I had to learn how to ride a streetcar, didn't I? I took a job as a helper for the engine overhaul mechanics at the Naval Air Station. And I had to, you know, learn to ride the streetcars down to the job, and then I got enrolled in this night school training program for the radio operators. And you very quickly learned how to make your way around, sort of like going on a new college campus, I guess. And we did have... a tremendous influx of people from the from down in Terrell County who were moving into that area looking for work.
Okay.
And so some of my old friends were up there in the area and were able to stay in touch with them, okay. Friends and relatives.
Okay.
So it was not completely new to me.
Right, right. Now, you said you were interested in radio operation, commercial radio operation. What led you to that interest? How far did you follow it?
Oh, well, I stayed actually 4 years in the sailing with the merchant ships,
mm-hmm.
Finished up the war, and then stayed on another couple of years after that as a radio operator in the merchant marine. It was, for one thing, at that period of time, it was a very well-paying job.
Okay.
You know, it was paying probably double the salary by going to sea that I could make trying to take any other job I could find around the mm-hmm. Norfolk area.
Were you trying to get a job like at a radio station, looking at that option?
No, not particularly. More interested in communication as you would have it in the military services or what have you.
Okay.
You not going commercial for broadcasting or anything like that.
Okay. Okay.
Didn't have much interest in that.
Okay.
And it was when the war ended, we began to send all these ships up the river to the boneyard.
Mm-hmm.
And by 1948, I'd say it was pretty clear, 47, 48, that this was not going to be a career field you'd want to stay in. It was. It was too hard to keep a job, so I was just looking around, and I had this opportunity to go into the aviation cadet program for the Air Force.
Okay.
And so I took it.
Okay.
And that was the whole shift for me, and of course I made a career out of the Air Force after that.
Going back to your Merchant Marine experience, what was it the pay that drew you into that, working with the radios there on those ships, or was it trying to contribute to the war effort?
Well, I had an uncle that had been in the Merchant Marine for years,
mm-hmm.
and he was always telling all these good sea stories, you know, and I think that attracted me in that direction,
mm-hmm.
and then knowing that when I turned 18, I'd be drafted for the Army or somebody,
mm-hmm.
This looked like a very viable alternative that I could control my own future, mm-hmm. you might say.
Okay.
So, in fact, that's just the way it went. When they sent me my draft notice, I reported to the board,
mm-hmm.
took my federal communications licensing and everything with me, and they just sent me right on over to the War Shipping Administration and signed me up right there.
Okay.
To go into the Merchant Marine.
And did your family have any other military experience?
No, I'm the only. As far as I know, I'm the only person in my family that's ever been involved in the military.
Huh. Any of your children now, have they been involved at all?
No, I have five children. The closest to the military, one of them is technical director at the National Security Agency.
Okay.
And that's a similar type of government service, but it's not in the military.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have three sisters.
Okay. Were they younger or older than you?
I have, they're all three younger. One of them's about 3.5 years younger, and the other two were extremely late in my parents' life. They're, one's about 19 years younger, and the other one's about 21 years younger.
Okay,
So it's two families, really.
Right, right. So describe your experiences and what your duties were in the Merchant Marine during World War II.
Well, during the war, we manned the radio room 24 hours a day on the ship. I was sailing Liberty ships.
Okay.
And
can you describe what those were?
Well, there wasn't much duty at all because we had radio silence the whole time we were at sea unless you were sinking. Now, you did regularly receive messages.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically our big job was to be sure we got all of our messages that were sent to us,
mm-hmm.
and get them into the captain of the ship and the crew, you know,
okay.
the deck crew. We received regular weather reports, and we also did some intership communication using light signals.
Okay.
My first trip was about 62 ships in convoy out of Tampton Roads,
mm-hmm.
into the Mediterranean.
Okay.
And these ships are all plugging along across the ocean at 6 knots.
Wow.
six or seven knots. So it's a long trip.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And, of course, you were under German submarine surveillance a good bit of the time, and actually, occasionally they'd take a shot at you with a torpedo if they thought they could get it. We lost a couple of ships out of our convoy on the first trip over, and my ship never took a torpedo hit, but on the second trip that I made over that same route to the Mediterranean, we were on the right flank, and the ship was equipped with a long steel web net that they would drop over with the booms on each side of the ship to hold it about 15 feet out, and you drag it through the water. And if a torpedo comes in, that net will catch it. And we caught a torpedo.
Wow.
When we lifted them at the end of the day to check them out, there it was, hanging in it.
And it had not detonated, obviously.
No, it didn't detonate, and they kind of used the hoist equipment to jerk it and snap it a few until the thing fell off and went in the water. So,
how did you feel like the convoy was a successful or efficient way to get supplies over to the European theater?
Well, at that time, it was basically the only way to get them over there. You know, we didn't have the big airplanes we have today that can move so quickly. But when you think 62 ships and the immense load that they can carry, that's a lot of stuff being delivered.
Sure is.
And it takes a while to get there, and of course, finding a place to unload it could often be a problem. My first trip was into southern France, and we got up to Marseille, and this was almost immediately after the invasion of southern France. And we got the ships into the harbor there, and we had to wait about 5 or 6 days before we could get close enough in that we could unload.
About how many missions did you run, or convoy missions did you run across the Atlantic?
I ran two during the war.
Okay.
And then, the war ended over there in spring of 45.
Yes, sir.
So, and I started out in late 44.
Okay.
So I got two convoys during wartime, and then the war was over, and then I stayed on after that. And, the submarines weren't shooting anymore, but boy, the Mediterranean was still full of mines, and so was the English Channel, and it was quite a while before they got all the mine sweeping done to make it safe.
Now, you came back and you stayed in Norfolk, is that correct?
I came back and sort of stationed myself out of Norfolk to, catch ships to travel on.
Okay.
But very often, if you got on a ship, if you wanted a job, you had to stay on it, because if you dropped off, somebody else took your position. And so a couple of ships I stayed on quite a while, as much as a year, year and a half, with most of the same crew.
And you were working the radios then?
Yeah, I was. Once the war was over and clear, they went down to just one radio operator.
Okay.
So you were on, and you sort of set your own shift to make it fit, the best schedule for the ship. That was pretty good work.
Okay. How long did you do that?
I made my last trip ended my last trip in December of 48, December 48, because
okay.
And then in May of 49, I was in the Air Force.
Okay. Now, what prompted you to join the Air Force?
Well, my second interest behind radio had always been flying.
Okay.
I had a great curiosity about it and really thought I'd like to try it.
Mm-hmm.
And on one of my breaks in the Merchant Marine while I was at Norfolk, the recruiting team was there recruiting for aviation cadets or other people, and they actually contacted me and tried to recruit me as a radio operator for the B-29s.
Huh.
Okay. And I went down and talked to them about it, and finally I told them, I said, considering the salaries you guys pay for radio work and the salary I get where I'm working now, it doesn't make much sense for me to go into Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, how would you like to fly? And, boy, he had my attention. I said, that sounds better.
Uh-huh.
So I took all the examinations. again, coming out of the Gumneck High School down there, I hadn't had a lot to do. But I managed to pass an examination that gave me the equivalent of 2 years of college, which you had to have to get in the program. And then I passed another examination for the flying skills part of it and managed to make the physical a few days later over at Langley Field. And just like that, I was on the list to come into the program for flying training. So that was all wrapped up in, I guess, around August or September of 48. Yeah, 48. And I made
48 or 49?
It would have been 48.
48?
Yeah, that I wrapped up all this these exams.
Okay.
And I had time left to make one more short trip in the Merchant Marine, so I went over to Brest in France and back on a quick turnaround and got back and then just stayed ashore until time to go to training in Texas.
Okay. Tell me about your training in Texas. This was in San Antonio?
San Angelo.
San Angelo.
Goodfellow Air Force Base in San Angelo. I reported down there in May of 1949.
Okay.
And was assigned to Class 50B Aviation Cadet Training.
Okay.
It was a one-year-long course broken into two parts, primary training and then basic training.
Okay.
And the primary training was basically learning how to fly an airplane and also learning the basic military skills that you needed to be an officer in the Air Force.
Okay.
And the program was modeled very much along the lines of the military academy, except it only lasted 1 year. So you, instead of 4 years, you had four quarters. You advanced at the end of each 3 months to the next level of military training.
Okay.
And in the meantime, you're down at the flight line about half of every day working on your flying training.
Okay. How did you react to the military life, the discipline, you know, and everything? You'd been in the Merchant Marines, and then you go to the Air Force. What was that like, the transition like for you?
Well, it was a very difficult thing, and you had to go into it understanding that they were going to put you through a lot of, they'll make you jump through the hoops. How's that?
Right.
In the first 3 months as a freshman, so to speak, a plebe, whatever name you want to give it, you were under absolutely strict regimentation. I mean, you marched everywhere you went, even if you were by yourself.
Okay.
And there was, some people would call it harassment or hazing, I guess, but I think it had a point. For instance, we were out at about 5:45 every morning. We had a formation, we were checked, and then we marched off to breakfast.
Okay.
And our breakfast during that first 3 months, you sat at attention at the table, eyes straight ahead, and ate a square meal. In other words, when you picked up your spoon, it went straight up, level to your mouth, and straight in.
Right.
And it came out the same way. Well, you know, that's a hassle, but you learn to live with that. And then when you finished, you asked to be excused from your head man at the table, and they would excuse you to go back to clean up your barracks and shave and this kind of thing, do your toilet duties. But on your way back, walking, marching by yourself, at every intersection or street, you had to stop, and you had to look to the left, or actually do a left face to the left, and then an about face to your right, and then a left face back to the front, and then bend over and look between your legs behind you. And then you would stand up and say, "All's clear, sir," and you'd walk across the street.
Was there somebody you were actually speaking to, or you just...
Anybody that was there.
Anybody?
Nobody was there, you said it anyway.
Okay.
Sure, if you didn't, somebody would see you, and you'd be in trouble.
Right.
Well, you know, that relaxed. The upperclassmen were the ones that primarily enforced this, because they had already been through it, you know, and they were ready to nail you if you didn't do it. But anyway, we put up with that for that first 6 months, and we learned how to fly the old A-6 AT-6 or Texan,
okay,
trainer plane, and at the end of that one, we sort of graduated from that phase of the training and went out to another base,
mm-hmm,
to either advanced multi-engine or to advanced fighter.
Okay.
I asked for and was interested in flying the multi-engine airplanes. I had much more interest in flying those than I did the fighters, and that's what I did, and I wound up right there in your backyard at Reese.
Right.
Reese Air Force Base.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, what was it like, if we go back, what was it like for you to first get into the cockpit of an airplane and actually fly?
Well, you know, that was an interesting exercise. I'd never been in an airplane except as a passenger a couple of times in the back, and it's quite a thrill.
Right.
And it took a while to get accustomed to the fact that I'm up here in the air, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I was not a real fast learner on the flying skills. I had to work pretty hard at it.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, on my first check ride, mm-hmm, to go solo,
mm-hmm,
I flunked. And they reassigned me to another instructor who was a good old Southern boy from Louisiana that talked like I did.
Okay.
And in a matter of a week's time, he had me soloed and gone.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, what did you do wrong to flunk the first time?
Well, it's hard to say. I think I was probably just, you know, nervous, edgy, because and the instructor I had was a real nail, you know, he chewing you out all the time. I won't be careful what I say since I'm recording here.
Well, you say whatever you want to say.
Well, he was a horse's tail.
Okay.
I'll put it that way.
Okay.
And I think he just had me so much on edge that I was making mistakes I didn't need to make, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when this second instructor picked up on me, it was a whole different world. Just like that, I began to, and I had no trouble. Went right on through, solo, finished, got all, did fine. But that was a real stumbling point for me at that particular place.
Right. Now, why did you, you said you were interested in flying the multi-engine planes versus the single engine. Why was that?
Well, I think it's just probably survival instinct. I like to look out the window and see some fans on each side, you know. Then when one quits, I don't have to come down by parachute.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know that was it, but I just had the feeling that I would really like to fly those larger airplanes, and I did.
Okay.
That was a good decision for me. Mm-hmm. I did fly some single engine later on, but I never flew single engine jets.
Okay.
In fact, three and a half, 4 years after I finished training at Reese, went on my first assignment, I was back at Goodfellow as an instructor.
Oh, okay.
In the same airplane.
Wow. Interesting.
CT-6s.
Now, when did you first fly a multi-engine airplane? Was that
at Reese?
At Reese.
Yeah, as a student, aviation cadet. But when we arrived at Reese, we continued in the AT-6 for about 2 months,
mm-hmm,
but a different approach. We were learning to fly by instruments on it,
okay,
rather than flying by visual.
And what airplane were you flying?
We started in the AT-6,
okay,
the instruments.
Okay.
And then from the AT-6, we went into the B-25s.
Okay.
And that was the real multi-engine experience. It was twin-engine. It was a World War II Billy Mitchell bomber that had been stripped of all the combat equipment, was being used as trainer.
Okay.
And it was really a great airplane to fly.
How different was it for you to fly that plane versus flying the single-engine planes?
Well, it was a whole world of difference. In the B-25, you had a tricycle landing gear and a cockpit up front where you could see something.
Mm-hmm.
In the old AT-6, sitting back with a conventional tailwheel landing gear with the engine out in front of you, you couldn't see anything.
Okay.
Except out the sides.
Right.
And then the B-25 with two engines was a very well-balanced airplane. You fly it. The old T-6s had been around so long and been bounced by students so long that the wing loading was unbalanced on them. You come in for a landing, and as you slowed down and lost the speed to the point where the airplane was stalling and converting to a ground roller, mm-hmm. one wing always seemed to stall ahead of the other one, which okay. means the airplane would try to roll either
right.
With that. Those things you didn't see anymore with the B-25s. You
okay.
just bring them in, and it was a much easier airplane to fly.
Right. How long were you at Reese?
We were there all together for 6 months.
Okay. This
yeah.
is in 1950.
Yeah, that was in 1950. I graduated on May 12, 1950.
Okay.
And I had started on May 3rd, I think it was, in 1949 at Goodfellow. So it was a year-long program.
Okay.
And we were graduated and had a ceremony in the old base theater there. We'd get our wings and get our gold bars.
Okay. How did your parents feel about you becoming a pilot?
Oh, I think they were satisfied with that. If they had any, any feelings about it, they never expressed them to me other than good feelings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
My mother was worried about me during the war on the ships, and, you know, well, God, they're going to sink your ship and you'll die and all this.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't. Mind the airplanes too much, I think.
Okay. How would you rate your training you had received for this year of primary and basic training?
I thought it was well done, you know. They certainly, except for the one instructor I had, it was such a pain. The curriculum was good. The ground school to support it was tied very closely to what you needed to have without a lot of extraneous stuff. And most of our ground school people were civilians,
okay.
working for civil service.
Okay.
And I particularly remember one of them, a fellow by the name of Mr. Kemp,
okay.
that I thought was really great in the ground school there.
Okay.
But the same thing I could say, I guess, for Reese, the military instruction was done all by that. Military career instruction
mm-hmm.
was all done by, for the most part, by military officers.
Okay.
And they were pretty good at their job.
Mm-hmm.
Had no question about that.
Okay. At this point, had you received any weapons training?
We just received some very basic introduction, really, to firing on the range with rifles.
Okay.
I forgot. In the Springfields, anyway, the older rifles that they, I forgot what it was. It was not the M16. It was before that.
Okay. Now, where did you go after Reese in 1950?
Okay, from Reese, graduated and second lieutenant, finally free to get married, went back to North Carolina and got my bride, and we moved to Sacramento, California, to Mather Air Force Base. And I was assigned as a line pilot flying B-25s, and we were training the bombardiers that would go on to the B-29s.
Okay.
They had a bombing range out there at Beale Air Force Base, not far from Sacramento, and we do is load up these practice bombs with students, bombardier students and their instructors, and take them up there and fly around the bombing range for 2 or 3 hours while they got their bombing training
okay.
practice.
Okay.
And stayed out there. How long did I stay there? About a little over a year and a half.
Okay.
I managed, by the way, while I was there through the Air Force's bootstrap training program to complete my bachelor's degree California State University at Sacramento.
Okay.
So that was the biggest advance in my career that I got out of that.
Okay.
And all. Pardon?
What was your major in?
History, social studies,
okay.
and geography.
Okay.
That was the one that was easiest for me to reach in the limited time I had.
Okay.
And from there, my unit was the whole unit was moved down to Waco,
okay.
to James Connolly Air Force Base down there, and we. Continuing a similar type of training there with the B-25s, but using radar rather than visual bombing.
Okay.
And we stayed there just a little while, and then we moved to Shepherd.
Okay.
the whole unit again and continue the same work at Shepherd. And then the unit was closed down because the B-29s were being taken out of the inventory and replaced by B-50s, and they no longer needed that kind of training.
Okay.
And so they let us ask for what we wanted to do, and I thought I'd like to be a flight instructor, so I asked for that, and sure enough, right back to Goodfellow. But I did have to go through a six-week flight instructor's training school down at Craig Air Force Base in Alabama to get prepared for that.
Okay.
And then I went back and stayed at Goodfellow until 54.
Okay.
And, trained a lot of students while I was there.
Now, this is during the Korean War or just after?
Yeah. During the Korean War and following it. The biggest break that came at when I went back to Goodfellow's, about a year after I got back there, they decided to make it a basic training school rather than a primary and use B-25s. Well, the B-25 was the airplane I really knew how to fly by then. So I was given an opportunity to go down to Georgia to the Air Force's instrument instructor school for instrument pilots. That was, at that time anyway, was the premier, outside of test pilot school, that was the premier school that all pilots wanted to go for. And I stayed down there, I guess, 12 weeks, and learning to fly the airplane under every possible condition of instrument flight.
Okay.
And I consider that to be the one biggest impact on my flying career, because I'm pretty sure it saved my life a time or two later on.
Really?
And the fact that, I mean, when I left that school, I figured I could fly anywhere in the world and do anything. That's how good it was.
Wow.
You know, it was a great school.
Now, how did they put you through these? Were these simulations, or did you they put you up in the plane? And
You spent most of the plane. There were simulators. You flew those. But I was routinely able to, we're talking now in the 50s, not with all this modern stuff we got today.
Right.
I was routinely shooting touch-and-go landings under the blindfold inside the cockpit.
Oh, wow.
And, never see the ground. And that takes a lot of confidence in your ground control operator, the GCA guy, or what have you.
Absolutely.
Of course, I had an instructor pilot sitting in the seat that could see what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But you knew you could do it when you finished that school.
How long was that school?
My best recollection is it was either 12 or 14 weeks. I think 12 weeks.
Okay.
And you flew, 5 days a week you were out there flying, and or in the simulators flying.
Mm-hmm. Now, at this point, you've been in the military now for, what, five years?
Yes. I was commissioned in 50, and this would have been around 54.
Okay. Did you think that you were going to continue making a career out of this, or did you have thoughts of getting back into civilian life?
Well, I had to make a decision. Let's see. That was about the time I made a decision to go ahead and stay in.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a reserve officer, and having finally gotten a college degree behind me and what have you, I was considering applying for what we call the regular commission for the regular Air Force or regular Army or regular whatever, rather than remaining in the reserve. And I actually did finally apply for it and did receive a regular commission. So I'm a retired regular officer rather than a reserve officer.
Okay. Okay.
And yep. that was the career commitment then.
Okay.
Yeah, when I did that.
You felt comfortable with making this decision?
Yeah.
You thought the Air Force was going to provide you a...
Well, my wife and I, we took about a three-week leave, came back to North Carolina and shopped around the job market and looked at things. The most likely field for me to go into would be education with the training I had, and it didn't look too favorable, to be honest about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided to stay with the military.
Okay. Now, you went back to San Angelo, and you were a flight instructor. And you trained on B B-25s, is that correct?
Well, when I went back there, I was back in the T-6 again.
Back in the T-6, okay.
Yeah, as an instructor sitting in the back seat where you really can't see anything. and you got some kid off the street in the front seat that doesn't know what he's doing.
Did you have some controls back there?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Okay.
That was very interesting. I found a great deal of satisfaction teaching those kids how to fly, I'll tell you. It was challenging. And quite often we'd pick up a student. I had a French kid that not only had never flown before, but didn't speak English too well.
Oh, wow.
so you have a lot of, we'd get an occasional student from some of the foreign air forces there too.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was a good time. When I got back from the IPIS, Instrument Pilot Instructor School, I went with the what they call the Base Standardization Board, which put me at a level where I was supervising a lot of the other instructors and making sure they were with the program. And I continued that until they decided to ship me to Labrador.
Okay.
And so I wound up going from Goodfellow up to Labrador in 1955.
What did you think of American policy in Asia at this point? This is Korean War, just after Korean War. Were you following regularly what was happening in the world? I guess you kind of had to a point.
Oh, yeah. You followed it pretty well. And, of course, you had an interest in it. I lost my best friend all through cadets when it went in the mountains out there in a B-26 in Korea.
Mm.
Night flying. And so these things keep your attention all the time. But I tended pretty much to agree with the decision to go into Korea. And I pretty much agreed with the decision to go into Vietnam, as we'll be talking about later, except I just disagreed with the objectives there.
Okay. So your transfer to Labrador, what was your duty there?
I was assigned up there initially as a single engine pilot because I was qualified in both, and I was flying one of these little bush pilot type airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
We had what's known as a composite squadron there. We had the de Havilland Beavers, which is the bush pilot airplane on
mm-hmm.
floats,
mm-hmm.
and then we had some C-47s. We had an SA-16 amphibian. Had two kinds of helicopters, I guess.
Were you trained on those?
I was not trained on the helicopters, so I didn't. Okay. I flew them a little bit as a co-pilot from time to time, just to help out.
Mm-hmm.
And because I happened at that time have the extra duty of being the squadron flying safety officer, so
okay.
I like to keep an eye on everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the single engine assignment they sent me on didn't last but about 2 months. And it wasn't really a job there. So they just moved me over to the C-47 transports, which is a two-engine thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't too difficult for me to check out in that, and that's what I flew in Labrador.
Okay. Was this the first time you'd flown a transport plane?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was the first time I had checked out in a C-47. I had flown the T-29 Convair, which was a much later model airplane than any of the others.
Mm-hmm.
In California.
Okay.
I had checked, they'd selected about six of us to check out in that, and I was fortunate enough to be one of them. And that was a great airplane, but anyway, the C-47 was a little tricky. It was a tail wheel plane,
mm-hmm.
and it was a leftover from World War II,
mm-hmm.
and it was not very well equipped to be flying in Labrador and north of there because it didn't have the cold weather
mm-hmm.
Capabilities that you really need up there.
Right.
Labrador was the, that year I spent up there was the worst year I had in the Air Force.
Why is that?
The equipment that we were flying with, this was 1955 mm-hmm. and 56, and we were building the distant early warning radar line about 300 miles inside the Arctic Circle.
Oh, wow.
To the north.
Okay.
And a lot of our flying was in support of that, and the area was unmapped. We didn't have the radio navigation aids.
Mm-hmm.
The C-47 had nothing but real old World War II navigation equipment on it. Mm-hmm. And to be honest about it, it was a good bit of flying you do up there. You didn't really know where you were. And in the wintertime, if you go down up there, you're just dead.
Right.
I mean, that's all she wrote. And we had a fair number of missions from Goose Bay north. Mm-hmm. When we have what you normally speak of as a point of no return.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, you take off from Goose Bay, you're going up to Frobisher Bay, which is where we would normally go up to. And there was a point about two-thirds of the way up there when you didn't have enough gasoline to come back to Goose.
Right.
So you were going on to Frobisher. Well, your communications in those days were all high-frequency radio and very, not very good. And so you might be bugging along up there, and you pass the point of no return, and you finally get hold of Frobisher and talk to him, and, well, we got some fogs moved in. And that's when you begin to get stomachache.
How many times did that happen to you?
I went up on you with me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I went up on one trip up there with, let's see, I had pilot, myself, I had a co-pilot, navigator, and we had two flight engineers, and we had a three-man team from the Air Force's Arctic Desert Tropic Institute. Mm-hmm. And we went to Frobisher and started from Frobisher and worked our way all the way across the continent to Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And into Alaska, and we were stopping at these various little radar sites that were being built. And if there was a lake nearby, we would land on the lake, and these guys from the Arctic Desert Tropic Institute would get out and drill holes in it.
Mm-hmm.
To see if they could calculate whether or not it would support the weight of a C-124 Globemaster that they wanted to fly in with the antennas that were going to be put up.
Okay.
Yeah, these antennas were being built down here in the States, and they would, when they had the antennas built and calibrated, they would cut them exactly in half so that they could then load the two halves into a Globemaster and fly them up there.
Mm-hmm.
But they needed a Globemaster, a big four-engine heavy transport. And so our job was to land on it to see if it would support an airplane.
Oh, my gosh.
The bad part about all this was that you got there with your C-47, on these little outlying places, you didn't dare shut your engines down because you couldn't get them started again.
Because it was so cold.
Yeah, 40 below zero, and some 50 below zero.
Wow.
So these guys are having to climb out, and you sit there and your engines at the slowest idle you can, and then they drill their holes and get their information, and then you pick up and go. And of course, you have to spend the night somewhere, and then you do shut down, and that was always an interesting experience with the airplane. You had to, the system was there to pump raw gasoline into your oil tanks after you landed.
Okay.
And were preparing to shut down for the night. You diluted the oil with raw gasoline, and then you ran the engines enough to get some of that circulated in, and then you shut them down for the night.
Mm-hmm.
Next morning, to try to get them started, you had to pull three big Arctic heaters out of the airplane,
mm-hmm.
and hook them through hoses up to the front of each engine and one hose up into the cockpit of the airplane. And then you get those big heaters cranked up and going, and that was an interesting exercise, too, because they don't start very well at 40 below either.
Right. How long would it take for you to de-ice or heat up the plane?
It took about 3 hours from the time you started until the time you could start your engines. 2.5 to 3 hours, and then when your engine started, you had to sit for another hour running at sort of a little bit of a fast idle to evaporate the gasoline out of the oil that you put in the night before. Because if you took off immediately with the oil that thin, your engine bearings would go. You'd burn up your engines.
Sounds like a really arduous set of tasks to do to land and to take off.
Well, and the When on airplanes, the landing gear has normally there's some lights in the cockpit that tell you whether the gear is up or down, mm-hmm. and whether it's in transition. For instance, if the gear is up, the lights will be off.
Mm-hmm.
You drop or the handle or the switch or to lower the gear, a yellow light comes on for each one to show they're in transition,
mm-hmm.
and then when they get into their there's a red light, I guess, that comes on. Then when they get full down and are locked in position,
mm-hmm.
you get a green light.
Okay.
So you're always looking for the green lights before you come in to land.
Right.
In the Arctic at that temperature, in the C-47, you just had to forget that because all those switches were frozen.
Oh, gosh.
You put the handle down, and you waited long enough, and you hoped for the best. It was stressful.
I can imagine. Did you ever have any close calls, any problems?
I had one... one or two that were pretty bad in it. We're flying from Frobisher Bay back down to Goose.
Mm-hmm.
Thank goodness I had her up to about 11,000-12,000 feet, even though you're not supposed to go above 10 without oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an undercast, and I was wanting to stay above it, get sunshine. And we had two or three passengers on board that were coming down, and we were along the coast there in that whole area. It's an area sort of like the coast of Norway. It's just one big, not ravine. I can't think of the word now.
No.
Gorge.
Fjords?
Gorges going down.
Okay.
That's not the right word for it. But anyway, you know that that's what it's like down underneath. It's just
uh-huh.
Some of them have like ice flows going down them and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, that's the kind of terrain that you know is down underneath that cloud. And all of a sudden, I see the fuel pressure on my right engine falling fairly rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
And I started almost immediately to go into the procedure. The first thing with the C-47 you did was switch tanks and turn on booster pumps to pump fuel and a bunch of things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she went all the way dead and quit. And then I saw it fluctuating on the left one. I thought, oh, boy. But by the one going a little bit ahead of the other, the left one caught back up. So I had one engine going. But by then I had drifted down into the clouds. And I really don't know how close I was to those mountains and gorges down below us, but it couldn't have been very far. And we got the thing leveled off, staggering along at minimum airspeed while I tried to get that right engine restarted after the fuel pressure came up. And finally got it started, and it barked and backfired and carried on and got it running and got it going. And come to find out that the trouble was that at the time this happened, we were running on an auxiliary tank that was mounted back in the cabin to get us the length of the trip.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my passengers had propped his feet on a shutoff valve.
Okay.
And it shut the fuel off back there. And, when I switched tanks, of course, I switched back to the internal tanks,
mm-hmm.
but that's, you know, that could have been deadly.
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
That would have been another one of those crashes. And it had several cases where landing on those lakes,
mm-hmm.
On the ice, you'd wind up going down them sideways, which is not a thrill either, because if you had any crosswind at all, and you're landing on ice, you have no control over what happens after you slow down to about 30, 40 miles an hour. That big old tail sitting in the back is like a weather vane,
uh-huh.
and it just blows the ship around, and you're going down the strip sideways.
Gosh.
And brakes are, you know, it makes no difference putting on brakes when you're on ice.
Right.
So you had. I considered it my worst year. It had been a long time since I'd had many dental problems. I had 7 fillings that year.
Okay.
I don't know if that caused it or not, but
something happened.
Something was happening, and I didn't have as much hair at the end of that year as I had when it started either.
I can understand that. So but, where did you go after this year in Labrador?
Well, I came back to a real nice assignment at the University of Cincinnati,
mm-hmm.
as an Air Force ROTC instructor.
Okay.
I was supposed to come back to my old favorite school, East Carolina University, but the orders got changed at the last minute, and I wound up in Cincinnati.
Okay.
So we did 3 years at Cincinnati in the Air Force ROTC program, just teaching and working with the kids there.
Mm-hmm. You're teaching in the classroom?
Yeah, teaching in the classroom, and also one of those years, the last year I was there, I was a Commandant of Cadets, so I was spending more time on the military training with our training sergeants and what have you down in the gym and out on the football field.
Okay.
When I left there, I felt like I probably did a pretty good job there because when I left, I received an invitation to apply for one of the positions at the Air University down at Maxwell Air Force Base.
Right.
And as a professor on the faculty there.
Mm-hmm.
So I did, and that's where I went for the next four.
Okay.
Yeah, down in Montgomery, Alabama.
How did you enjoy the teaching? This would be your third assignment, basically, as an instructor and a teacher and a mentor.
Yeah.
Did you feel comfortable with that kind of position, that job?
Well, I enjoyed that work, and the opportunities were offered to me, so I took them.
Right.
I was aware from the beginning that this was probably not going to ever get me to a position of being a general or even a full colonel, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But it was work that I liked and wanted to do, so I stayed with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And had a great tour at Montgomery. Just one of the best tours I ever had.
That was for 4 years. Is that correct?
Four years. It was a three-year assignment with a fourth-year optional, and so we stayed to 4 years.
And at this point, you had obtained your bachelor's degree. Is that it?
While I was at Cincinnati, mm-hmm. I got my master's degree.
Okay. And what was that in?
That was in education, education administration.
Uh-huh. Okay. And so what did you teach exactly at the War College down there at Maxwell?
Do again?
What did you teach at Maxwell? What was your major?
Yes, sir. I was primarily involved in teaching teachers how to teach. How's that?
Okay.
I was assigned to the faculty of the Academic Instructor School.
Okay.
And all of the officers and all of the NCOs that were heading out to the major teaching jobs in the Air Force were sent down there for a six-week course on how to teach.
Okay.
And that is just all that course was about. It was really good. In addition to that, in the areas I worked in, I did some lectures at the Air War College,
mm-hmm.
Did some lectures at the Command Staff School and the Squadron Officer School, and also at the Dental Officer School over at Gunter Air Force Base in that area.
Okay.
So I was working in all of those areas.
Now, this is, you're there, I guess, from 1959 to 63, is that right?
Let's see, that sounds about right, 59 to 63, that's right. In September 63, I transferred to Panama to United States Air Force headquarters down there.
Okay. Now, how much were you aware of what was happening in Indochina at this point?
Well, quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Being there at the Air University, we got regular briefings on, you know, what was going on, and,
mm-hmm.
and of course, I was always free to walk in and sit in on some of the classes where this was being discussed at the Air War College or the other schools.
Mm-hmm.
So they pretty well kept us aware of what was going on, I think.
Okay.
And incidentally, I didn't mention it, but when the Cuban crisis
mm-hmm.
popped up,
mm-hmm.
That's while I was at Montgomery.
Mm-hmm. In October 1962.
Yeah, they plucked me right out. My wife didn't even know where I was for about 3 weeks.
Where did they send you?
Well, I was one of the guys who could fly that T-29.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I was hauling folks.
Were you stationed down at Key West, or did you?
I just flew back and forth between Key West, Washington, all up and down the East Coast and around. Wherever they needed somebody moved.
Right.
And finally, they didn't need me anymore, so I was released back. Back to my regular job.
Right.
That was a scary time, too.
I was going to say, how did you feel? I mean, that was a very precarious time for the world. How did you feel being part of that?
Well, I was glad that I could help out in dealing with it, and you can bet your boots I was following everything that was going on mm-hmm. that I could in the news and what have you. Mm-hmm. But like anyone else, I was concerned about my family.
Right.
I wasn't there to lead them into anything or, you know, help them with anything.
Right. How many kids did you have at this point?
I had at that point, I had the fifth one was born there in Montgomery.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, five of them, and the fifth one was born in Montgomery.
Okay. What did you think of President Kennedy's decision-making during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, I felt pretty good about it. Mm-hmm. You know, I could see that we were just about ready to go to war,
mm-hmm.
and we were.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel like he made the right decisions as far as actually, or I guess this is not to blame him, but to basically pushing the United States up to the brink of war to meet the Soviet threat?
I don't think we could tolerate nuclear missiles mm-hmm. under Soviet control in Cuba. From there, they could have hit just about anywhere in the United States at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They were medium-range missiles.
Right.
And you didn't want to let them get in there and then have that threat hanging over you when you try to move.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I basically think that the people advising him were giving him good advice, whoever they were.
Right. Okay. So after Maxwell, after your tour there for 4 years, I guess, in Montgomery, where were you sent?
Well, from there I went to Panama.
Okay. And now, why did they transfer you down to Panama? Was this...
Well, I had the background for it. You know, I had both my civilian education and my military. I went down as an assistant training officer at the command level
okay.
to help with the oversight of all the training that was going on down there.
Okay.
And just about the time I got down there, the things begin to come alive down there because Cuba was stirring up again,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and we were working with just about every country down there in Central and South America trying to counteract that threat wherever we could. And up to that point, it had pretty much been a real sleepy backwater ever since World War II
mm-hmm.
wound down.
Mm-hmm.
So they were bringing in people, bringing in things, and we had opened up a tropics revival school down there to train our pilots and people, and so it was a good time to go down. I was an assistant command training officer for training,
mm-hmm.
and then the last year I was there, I was executive officer for the DCS operations. He pulled me out of the training and brought me up to run his office for him.
Okay. Did your family move down with you?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had a nice quarters right there on base at Albrook, and it was a real good tour for me. It's the only time my wife got to go overseas with me,
okay.
The climate was pretty good, and there was a lot of things to do and see down there. So schools were excellent for the children.
Mm-hmm. Good. What airplane were you flying mainly down there, or training these guys in?
I was mainly my primary job was not flying anymore,
right.
But I still maintained my instructor pilot status, and I was given flight checks
mm-hmm.
and flying missions in the C-47 and occasionally in the T-29s.
Okay.
We did not have the T-29s in Panama, but there were two or three of them out in the embassies down there,
mm-hmm.
and I would go down and do check rides with those guys.
Okay.
So. I did quite a bit of flying. I flew all over down there for both Central and South America from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But most of my work was back in the office.
How did you feel about being back in the office, kind of having more of an administrative desk job than?
Oh, that was fine. You know, as long as I was getting enough flying to keep me happy.
Okay. So how long were you in Panama?
Panama for, we arrived, I went down September of 60.
Mm-hmm.
And left in spring of 67.
Okay.
So about almost 4 years.
Okay.
Three and a half years.
Okay. What did you know about U.S. policy in Vietnam? Obviously, 65 is when we had troops on the ground for the first time in mass. But what did you think of U.S. policy in Vietnam?
Well,
This is before you went over, obviously. And
yeah, didn't know enough to make a good judgment on what the policy was doing, but it seemed to me like a good move to go in and try to help these people mm-hmm. stop the march of communism, so to speak. And at that time, we had the old domino theory, and mm-hmm. you know, if Vietnam falls, Thailand and Cambodia are next, and mm-hmm. Indonesia and so forth. Mm-hmm. And it kind of made sense. And
so you bought into that, or that was something that made sense to you?
Yeah, and it did. And I'm reaching, and I got my fingers tangled up some wire on my desk.
Okay.
Just a second, let me.
Okay, sure.
I had my feet moving too much down there, I guess. Okay, that'll take care of it. You know, our major job was in a whole other sector then. We were working Che Guevara
mm-hmm.
And the communist threat out of Cuba and the uprisings in Peru and
right.
and Venezuela. You could look about around that area most any time of any month and find a little uprising going on somewhere.
Right.
And so that's where our attention was being held. Mm-hmm. But we did get regular briefings in the headquarters on, you know, what was going on in China. And of course, we had access to Armed Forces television. We were getting news through that,
mm-hmm.
as well as the local Panamanian stations.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a concern at a later time, mm-hmm. actually a concern developing at that time, but it didn't seem to me that we were really trying to win the war. The objective had somehow been screwed around to the point where our real job over in Vietnam appeared to be to go over and keep the other guy from winning.
Okay.
And you got to draw a line between those two thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping the other guy from winning is not any way for you to win.
Right.
And I don't think we ever really got away from that.
Now, you were thinking this before you even got in country.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I could go back briefly just for a second, what kind of information and what kind of operations were you guys running or trying to run against Che Guevara and being aware of what he was doing in Central and South America?
Well, most of what was going on for our part was just supporting the embassies and the military assistance groups that were in most of these countries. We had some kind of military assistance group
mm-hmm.
helping, offering training to their people.
Mm-hmm.
And our position was to, you know, help put together these training groups and get them in there
mm-hmm.
And let them do their job.
Mm-hmm.
We did have an air commando squadron stationed there at Howard Air Force Base that did a lot of this kind of work for us. They would go in country with a team of five or six people to train the people on civic actions. We had a lot of that going on in several countries. We actually had one, believe it or not, we had one guy whose almost full-time duty was going in and teaching these people how to use artificial insemination on their cattle and sheep and stuff to improve
wow.
their herds.
Okay.
But this was just a part of what was going on down there. Still going on today, too. You don't hear much about it, but
yes,
it's happening all over the world.
Yes, sir. Yes,
those
sir.
Special forces are doing those things. They do a lot besides fighting.
Yes, yes. In 1966, Che was captured and killed by the Bolivian government. Did that have any repercussions on what you were doing there in Panama?
Oh, just made us feel better.
Got one guy out of the way.
Yeah.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. See, I got. Let me put this in the proper place. I got there in 63 in September.
Mm-hmm.
My family arrived just before Christmas in December. And then, I think within a month, we had a fairly substantial Panamanian uprising, I guess we'll call it,
mm-hmm.
in which they were shooting across the canal zone and into the canal
mm-hmm.
zone,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in Panama City where we were. Of course, we were in just about in lockdown position all over. I was over at Albrook in the headquarters, and my family was living temporarily over at Howard while we were waiting for regular quarters.
Mm-hmm.
And Howard's on the opposite side of the canal, So I couldn't get back and forth to see my family for about 4 days. Mm. And it was pretty nasty around there. But I'm guessing and remembering that this was more of a student problem than anything else. Mm-hmm. From periodically the students at the University of Panama there would rise up and rebel against something. Mm-hmm. And in this particular time, anyway, the real losers were the Panamanian people, because they took that opportunity to ransack the stores and mm-hmm. and what have you. But they were creating quite a problem over in the canal zone by shooting in there. And we helicoptered over a team of sharpshooters from the Army training post over on the other side of the isthmus. Mm-hmm. And they pretty soon eliminated the sniper problem that we were having.
Okay.
I don't know how many people they shot, but in about a matter of 3 or 4 days, this sniper shooting wasn't happening anymore.
Okay.
These guys came over there with their rifles and their night scopes and what have you, and, mm-hmm. and went to work.
Okay. So you were overseeing coordinating some of the training, the civic training that was going on?
Yeah, that and just managing the training for the Air Force people that were down there, too. Mm-hmm. A certain amount of training has to go on with all of them periodically.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the involvement there. And
what were your impressions of the Panama Canal?
Well, it was interesting.
That's something I've heard often.
Yeah. At the time, I wondered if the Panamanians would be able to manage it. And at a later time, as I thought about it, I figured they probably could. The Panamanians had been basically doing most of the work for years, mm-hmm. but not at the administrative level or the highest technical levels.
Right.
But they certainly had a core of workers that could step in and do it, and it appears that they've been successful with it.
Mm-hmm.
From all reports that I get, there's some question now about how much longer they can continue to operate it and make it pay for itself.
Right.
Because of the big ships that are being built that go around it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I was seeing just recently that they're now doing a study down there to see if they can build a second canal across there that would be with longer locks and deeper drafts that can handle bigger ships. But that's a long way out yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sir. So in 1967, you get your orders for Vietnam.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. How do they come through to you?
How did they?
How did you get these? Were you expecting to be sent over there, or were you?
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. I was anticipating it because the Air Force, for by that time for about 3 years, had been working on the premise that nobody should go back a second time until everybody had been the first time. You know.
Okay.
And since I haven't been over there, I figured I was prime material.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was.
Okay. And when you received your orders, did you think you would be flying, or did you think you'd have a desk administrative job over there, since it's kind of what you were doing in Panama?
Oh, I knew I'd be flying.
Okay.
They were looking for air crew members.
Okay, okay. And when did you go over, actually?
Oh, let's see. Left Panama in right around Memorial Day, I guess, in late in May, anyway. It took my family to Florida,
mm-hmm.
left them in the Miami area.
Okay.
I went on then to training for nearly 5 months worth of training before I was prepared to go over.
Okay.
So the first stop on the training routine was to Seward Air Force Base in Tennessee, to do what we call transition training into the C-130.
What was that like?
Well, that was, I really enjoyed that. It was hard. I had never flown four engines before. I'd always flown two.
Mm-hmm.
or one, but mostly two-engine airplanes, so I had to get acquainted with four. I had never flown an aircraft with jet engines, which the C-130 is a prop jet. Mm-hmm. It's actually a jet engine that's geared to propellers. So that was all new.
Okay.
And I'd never flown anything that was bigger than the biggest barn I ever had. So I enjoyed that, and that was how I went. First time I got in that big baby and got up in the cockpit with my instructor that was going to teach me how to fly it, you know, I'm looking up there, and I said, boy, this is a big thing. And he says, don't worry about it, son. So you just fly this cockpit. If you get this cockpit on the ground, the airplane will be behind you. That was a pretty good philosophy.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. I guess eases your worries about what's behind you.
That's right. And that's essentially what it worked out to be. You learned how to fly yourself, you know, and you made that airplane just a part of you. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I was there. I don't recall exactly the length of time, probably a month and a half or somewhere in that range anyway, mm-hmm. until I was proficient in flying the plane. And then they sent me down to Pope Air Force Base outside of Fort Bragg there in North Carolina.
Yes, sir.
And here is where you learn how to use this airplane as a weapon system.
Okay.
What do you do with it? And mm-hmm. and the use of a C-130 basically is to either haul troops, haul cargo, mm-hmm. jump troops out the back, or drop cargo out the back, or some of the other procedures we learned, like dropping it on sleds mm-hmm. and sliding it along the ground without actually touching down. And mm-hmm. you do all that when you're there, and if you're good enough, you graduate and you move on.
Okay. Was the C-130 air-conditioned?
Oh, yes.
It was?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
With the four engines, you said it was more difficult. Was it just harder to handle with four engines? I guess, of course, with the jets also.
Well, the thing that you immediately notice when you transition to the jet props is the power. Mm-hmm. Those things are powerful. Mm-hmm. The C-130, you can hold your brakes locked, run her up and get her at full power, crack the flaps, and it practically leaps in the air.
Wow.
We had to show proficiency at landing on a 2,000-foot long landing strip with it mm-hmm. as a part of the training.
Mm-hmm.
And we in Vietnam, we actually used it a lot on airstrips that were only about 2,000 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
And you consider the airplane loaded is around 160,000 pounds in those days.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of airplane.
Yes, sir.
To put down on 2,000 feet at about 160 knots and get it stopped before you go off the end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So at Fort Bragg, they were teaching you to use this thing as a weapon. Did you feel comfortable with that kind of training?
Yes. That's what I wanted to do with it,
uh-huh.
learn how to use it.
Uh-huh. Did you feel like your training was adequate?
It was very, very good.
Okay.
All the training, flying training I received in the Air Force, the people knew what they were doing and were doing a good job of teaching. The only one I ever had a problem with was that first instructor that couldn't teach me to solo.
Yeah, I've actually heard that from a number of Air Force veterans, that their flight training has always usually been very excellent.
Yes, I thought so.
Yes. Okay. So after Fort Bragg, how long were you there at Fort Bragg? Or actually?
You know, my memory tells me it was probably about 4 weeks, maybe 6 weeks.
Okay.
I didn't bother to look up the exact dates.
Okay.
Coming and going. Then from Fort Bragg, I had to go to Washington State to go through the Air Force Worldwide Survival School.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a 6 week long course.
How was that for you?
That was tough.
What did you go through then?
Well, they work from the day you hit. They're working on your physical conditioning
mm-hmm.
to get you in shape. You're running everywhere you go with big heavy combat boots and all that stuff on that you wear.
Mm-hmm.
You go through a strong course of POW operation,
okay.
And they can be real nasty.
What do they do to you, the POW? How do they prepare you for that?
Well, of course, you get lectures and you see movies and films, but then they put you through some exercises that's supposed to be teaching you how to evade. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that you never, almost never completely evade. They manage to catch you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's planned that way.
Your instructors.
Yes. And a lot of that, we actually did some, not like the Marines or the Army get it, but we did actually crawl under barbed wire with live fire over us and all of that as a part of the training.
Mm-hmm.
For escaping and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're caught, they give you about 2 days of, it seemed like 2 years, about 2 days of time to be squeezed into black boxes and mm-hmm. hammered and beat around on and this kind of thing to see how well you hold up.
Mm-hmm. How did you handle that?
Okay. It wasn't fun, but you figured it might come in handy sometime later.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to try not to let them, break you. There were a few guys that didn't finish.
And if you didn't finish, were you not allowed to continue with your Air Force career or your tour that you were getting ready to go in?
Well, you wouldn't be going that, and that pretty much ended your career,
right.
For all practical purposes. Now, the most difficult part of it for me was the final exercise, which was 3 or 4 days in the field. I've forgotten for sure. But they take about 4 or 5 of you out in a little group.
Mm-hmm.
They drop you off, and they hand you a live rabbit and say goodbye. Now, when they say they take you out, they take you about 40, 50 miles up in the mountains in the northern part of Washington State, almost to the Canadian border.
Okay.
And I was there in late November, so, snow was already on the ground. It was
mm-hmm.
cold,
mm-hmm.
bitter and nasty. Well, we killed our rabbit, and of course, we've had some instruction on what you're supposed to do to evade, and one of the things was if you think you're in trouble, you disperse. But anyway, we ate our rabbits, and they told us that we'd probably be picked up the next morning if we didn't get out of there. So we got out early the next morning. We had killed a rabbit, cooked it, and ate it,
mm-hmm.
and we started trying to make our way over. And we had a map. We were supposed to work our way around to different points
mm-hmm.
and contact some partisans who would furnish us with food, if this kind of thing, and we're supposed to try to forage off the land. And I'm here to tell you, with snow on the ground in the mountains of Washington State in November, you don't eat much off the ground.
Mm-hmm. But it's hard to see what's on the ground.
And you don't catch many fish either.
Mm-hmm.
But in any event, the reason it was so difficult for me is that rabbit did something to my stomach, and I developed a good case of dysentery.
Okay.
But if you didn't finish that part of the course, you had to go through the whole course again.
Oh, boy.
Now, there's incentive.
Absolutely.
And I was determined to finish it, and they tracked us with dogs.
Hmm.
And if you got caught, you had to go through again.
Okay.
So I managed to evade all the way down, and I got to the late afternoon of the last day of the course.
Were you still in a group at this point, or are you by yourself?
No, by myself. I had evaded the dogs a couple of times by then by staying quiet and away from them when I could hear them coming.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really sick. So they had a system set up that you could signal if you were hurt or sick.
Mm-hmm.
And so I called, put up the signal, and in about a half an hour, medic showed up, wanted to know what trouble was, and I told him.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, do you want to come in?" I said, "No, I want you to do something about it so I can finish."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Okay." And he says, I can't recall what the medication, it was something they had to give you a shot in the hip,
mm-hmm.
mescaline or something like that. Anyway, mm-hmm. he said, "Drop your pants." And man, he hit me with that thing, and it did hurt. But it stopped the vomiting and dysentery.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it through tonight and got in the next morning and found a bus to take me back to the base. But I think it'd been a lot better experience if I hadn't gotten sick,
Right.
But I was really, I lost a lot of weight on that trip.
Mm-hmm. I bet so. Were your instructors there Vietnam veterans? Had they been in country?
The instructors in that survival school were real professionals. Mm-hmm. All of them had been into business a long time. One of the instructors there was an old friend of mine that was on my instructor team at the Tropic Survival School in Panama, mm-hmm. which I didn't mention to you. That was one of the, under my supervision in the headquarters, was a Tropic Survival School that we trained people who might go down in the tropics. Mm-hmm. And so I had some experience with survival schools, mm-hmm. so I knew what I was getting into.
Okay.
But he was there, and when I finished that night, he called me up and he says, I want you to come over. Kay's cooked up a big ham for our dinner tonight. You can imagine the shape I was in.
I can imagine, yeah.
So I says, Bob, I'm going to come. I says, please tell Kay if I don't eat very much to understand what the problem is.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And he says, yeah, that can happen. Uh-huh. And I still hear from him now. He's one of my regulars on the Internet that we pass stuff back and forth occasionally.
Good. What rank were you when you were at the survival school?
Lieutenant Colonel.
Lieutenant Colonel. Okay. Now, did they treat you any differently, being a fairly high-ranking officer?
Nope.
Not at all. Okay. Were you grouped with other people of similar rank, or were you with basically everybody?
No, you just went through with the group. If my airplane goes down, I'm the senior guy, but I've got some guys probably might only have three stripes back there in that loadmaster's compartment yet.
Yes, sir.
So you have to be able to work with everybody.
Okay. Another question about your training at Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina. Were the folks training you on that C-130 for combat maneuvers and using it as a weapon, were they Vietnam veterans? Had they been in country?
Just about all of them had already done tours over there.
Okay.
Because I was very late getting around in there to be called, so I was on the tail end of it more or less. So most of those guys, a lot of them had been over twice. Some of them, you see, prior to the Tet Offensive mm-hmm. in 69, things were pretty quiet for a long period there. And a lot of these guys just liked to go over there and fly because that's where they got to do their stuff, what they were trained to do. And besides, they got extra money, you know.
Mm-hmm. Combat pay.
Yeah, combat pay.
Right, right. Okay, so after the survival training, where did you go from there?
From there, I headed over to Mactan Island in the Philippines, which was where my unit was legally, formally stationed.
Okay. What unit were you with then?
774th Air Transport Squadron, I guess it was.
Okay.
Yeah, 774th Tactical Airlift Squadron. That's the right name.
Tactical Airlift?
Tactical Airlift Squadron, and that was the 463rd Tactical Airlift Wing.
Okay.
I should comment as to why we were in the Philippines.
Yes.
At that time, President Johnson had decreed we would only have, 600,000 men in Vietnam or some such number.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to keep that number below, the number of people over there below that stated goal,
mm-hmm.
Several of the flying units were stationed in the Philippines or in Taiwan or mm-hmm. Okinawa. All the C-130s were stationed off in the islands,
mm-hmm.
and we would take a crew in for 16 days
mm-hmm.
and fly missions for 16 days, and then we'd go back. The airplane would get its maintenance and catch up. You'd get 3 days of crew rest,
mm-hmm.
five if you were lucky, and then you would go back in again.
Okay.
So we never had a permanent duty station in Vietnam. We were always there on temporary duty.
And hence you couldn't be counted in, actually.
Well, if you stayed 15 days, you could count it as wartime service.
Okay.
That's why they had the 16-day rotation.
Okay. All right. So when you flew over to the Philippines, you know you're going into a war zone. How did your family react to this?
Like I said, we'd been a military family all our family life, and that was just an accepted part of what could happen.
Mm-hmm.
So while they would just as soon I didn't go, I'm sure,
mm-hmm.
they didn't, I think you didn't really question it.
Right. How did you feel going into the war zone?
Oh, well, I was kind of looking forward to go there and fly that airplane and see what I could do with it.
Yeah.
I was excited about it.
Mm-hmm. How about the other people in your unit going over? Were they kind of a similar feeling?
Well, you had to. I can't say that everyone was not wanting to be there, because I had some people that I knew that were not. I know of at least one or two guys that I always wondered about. One of them had been in Panama as an air commando, you know, and he just lost his gut for it, and they had to give him another job in the squadron that didn't involve flying in Vietnam. He couldn't hack it. And I had one or two others that I know actively were seeking jobs back on the islands that would keep them from going into Vietnam as aircraft commanders. But that wasn't too many of them.
Okay.
Just one or two.
Okay. And after you'd arrived in the Philippines, how long before you began your rotation into Vietnam?
Oh, 4 or 5 days.
Okay. Pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah. Well, what they did is they sent me in with an experienced crew the first time to learn the ropes. And we flew in, and I was in the seat part of the time, and part of the time I wasn't. But I was able to go through the whole routine, for the 16 days with them. And then came back and put together my own crew and went in again.
Okay. Did you find, before we get into kind of what you did on a daily basis, did you find that after you'd gone on this initial mission that you were really going to contribute to the war effort, that it was a very worthwhile mission that you were assigned?
Well, I felt like it was. We were committed to the, to defend that area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what my job was, to go over and support that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like we were doing a good job, and I was satisfied, with my part in it. I'd bring up the same concern I've had all along that I had before I got there, is it just didn't seem to me that we were trying to win the war.
Right.
We were just trying to keep the other guy from winning.
Right. Okay. So can you describe what your daily routine was like? I know things probably were different here and there, but basically what was your routine like flying these missions?
Well, what we would do when we hit Tonsonute Air Base there, where we were stationed in country.
Mm-hmm. That's where you would stay for those 16 days.
Yeah, my squadron flew into Tonsonute. They had another squadron out of Okinawa, I believe it was, that flew into Nha Trang. And so we had the different units going to different places where they had room for them. But it would boil down to something like this. We would fly in today, get in, get processed, and they would let us know where we're going to be staying.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be on the schedule usually for 8 o'clock the next morning.
Okay.
And it was for a 12-hour day.
Okay.
So you would report at your 8 o'clock. They would give you your assignment schedule for the day. It could be one long flight all the way up to the edge of almost practically North Vietnam, with 4 or 5 stops going up and 2 or 3 coming back, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be one where they've got a big troop movement going on, where you would go out and just shuttle troops from one place to another.
Okay.
And it sometimes the shuttle flight could be just, 20 minutes or less, or 30 minutes. So you learned about that each day when you got there, what your job was going to be that day.
Okay.
Then your navigator would go ahead and check the weather and start drawing up the navigation tacks. You would take your crew chief and your loadmaster, get out to the airplane and pre-flight it to make sure everything was in position for it. And your loadmaster would be working on his load going out. And usually by 9:30, 10 o'clock, you'd be off the ground and going.
Okay.
And you would fly your missions that were assigned, and then you'd come back in toward the end of your 12-hour duty day.
Mm-hmm.
And you had 14 hours off.
Okay.
This is important because it means that each day you show up for your flight 2 days later in the day. Like today you took off at 8 o'clock, tomorrow you're taking off or coming in at 10, the next day you're coming in at 12.
Okay.
And you're going to stay 16 days, so pretty soon, as I noted in some of the stuff I sent you, you find up that you find that you're getting breakfast with hamburger steak and supper with eggs and bacon.
Right. So every day it's 2 hours later, every day.
Yeah, and it's almost disorienting after a while. You forget what day it is or what time it is or anything else. Everything gets thrown off in your mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that efficient to you, or do you think it would have been better to have more of a regular schedule?
Well, I really have no idea why they went to the 14 hours. They needed the 12-hour crew day because of the nature of these little short field missions back and forth, to get max utilization out of the airplane. And I guess it must be based on some physical documentation that I'm not aware of that you need at least 14 hours of crew rest.
Okay.
So that's what they gave us.
Now, when you would show up there and check out your assignment, would you guys, I guess you became very familiar with some of these stops where you would go and what you'd be doing. Were you aware of like how hot this zone was going to be?
Well, you'd be briefed on that.
Okay.
You were briefed. You got an intelligence briefing as a part of that setup every morning on your area and the broader picture too.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And were there particular places in Vietnam that you guys just did not want to fly?
There were some that were very dangerous. The Oshawa Valley was one of them for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem there was that in order to get in there and land or to go in an airdrop, either one, mm-hmm. you had to make a long approach down a valley with high mountains on each side that usually had a lot of these big machine guns and that kind of thing waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost a few airplanes in there. So, when you had that kind of assignment, it got your stomach going a little bit.
Right. You said that you flew, or you state in your questionnaire here, your answers that you flew 392 combat missions.
Yeah, I looked that up so I could answer the question accurately in my records that I have.
Mm-hmm.
And 392 combat missions was what I was credited with there.
Okay.
And
when, where, and under what circumstances do you remember your first encounter with the enemy in combat? And I know that you wrote that you didn't have significant contact, but can you describe what you did have?
Well, almost every time, as I indicated in the stuff I wrote, that you flew into these little outlying airfields, the Viet Cong would snipe at you with small arms fire when you flew by.
Mm-hmm.
If you were low enough, they thought they could hit you.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for a lucky shot, I guess. And sometimes if you get one, one of the navigators in my squadron just standing up, looking out, took a bullet through the bottom of the airplane and right up into his rectum area.
Mm-hmm.
So, every once in a while they would get hit.
Mm-hmm.
In my own particular case, to my knowledge, I never came home with a hole in the airplane that I was flying.
Wow.
And that was just absolute luck.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I can say it, because we had them getting hit every day with the small arms. Now, you develop some tactics that you've been told about.
Mm-hmm.
If it was any of those airfields, I never came in below 3,000 feet till I was over the field. And then I just throttle back and do a big sweeping turn down and land. And when I was taking off in that sort of situation, I never take off straight ahead and hold a straight heading.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I was off the ground and going good, I just start a slow turn and vary the rate of turn from time to time until I got back above 3,000 feet and then head on out of wherever I was going. So that was my way of trying to deal with it.
But did they train you to do that, or was that your? Did you come up with that first?
Yeah, we were trained to do that kind of landings, to come out of a spiral like that and get in land. Yes,
mm-hmm.
I guess you'd call that. They were trained to just do it. The other thing in all these little airfields that we really had to use fairly often were some of these rapid delivery things,
mm-hmm.
because if you shut your motors off, you were inviting rockets, you know, to be fired in. So what you did, you unloaded on a run. Just about everything we hauled over there, other than people, were on pallets.
Right.
And these pallets can be mounted on rollers.
Mm-hmm.
So you would come off, you'd land, turn off the end of the runway, and do a fairly fast taxi up to the unloading area,
mm-hmm.
and then slow it down a bit. In the meantime, your loadmaster has lowered the back door down to where it's, you know, pretty close to the ground or the pavement or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just he unlocks the rollers, and you just use the momentum of the airplane to roll out from under the stuff and leave it laying there. And thump, 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 like a chicken running and laying her eggs. So then he'd keep the tailgate coming right back up, and you just keep right on rolling until you're back down at the other end of the runway, turn around and go. So that it has the effect of making you a less easy target.
Right.
Guess how, the way I'd put it.
How about offloading troops? How would you handle that?
Well, for offloading troops, you'd have to stop and drop the back door and just let them all,
mm-hmm.
you know, scramble out. So, some talking about loading and unloading, one of the interesting things that I don't know that it was ever a written policy, but the statement was pretty well understood that when you went in to haul some of these Vietnamese civilians and what have you to move them from one place to another when it was in a hot zone,
mm-hmm.
you would pull in and drop the back door down and have as many walk in as could get in,
okay.
and then lift the door up and go. If it was impossible to overload the airplanes with Vietnamese standing up.
How often did you carry Vietnamese civilians around the country?
They were moved from time to time when to in heavy combat areas to, you know, give them some protection.
Mm-hmm.
So thank goodness that was before the day of suicide bombers.
Right.
Yeah.
So this. Let me get this right. You went in, this is 1960, December 67 is when you went in country? Is that correct?
I went in December of 67, about the mid-December.
Okay.
By the time I got in there.
Okay.
And started flying regularly.
Uh-huh.
I got a two-week break about halfway through the tour to come back and see my family.
Okay.
And went back and...
you actually got to come to Miami?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, they flew me back to San Francisco, and I bought my own tickets from there.
Okay. Well, sir, let me ask you about that. This was mid-tour, so did you get out of your uniform to fly from San Francisco to Miami, or did you stay in uniform, or how did you handle that?
Well, that's when you found out how bad things were back here.
Yes, sir.
When I got off the airplane at Travis Air Force Base,
mm-hmm.
The contract airplane that flew us in from Tokyo, I guess, was down through Alaska and what have you,
mm-hmm.
I was advised to wear civvies before I went to the airport over at San Francisco to pick up my airplane to Miami.
Okay. And that was because they told you you might encounter some problems?
Yes. It's just, you know, San Francisco was a little bit of a hotbed anyway, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And this is it would be wise for you to change into civilian clothes before you catch a bus over to the airport in San Francisco.
Did you encounter any problems at all?
No.
Because they couldn't tell.
I had old civvies.
Right. Okay. What was those 2 weeks like for you when you came back?
Back in Vietnam, you mean?
No, when you came back to visit your family for 2 weeks. I mean,
it was wonderful.
Yeah.
And my wife did not have much to say to me about how they were being hassled off and on when I came back on leave.
Okay.
Not till I came back after the tour did she tell me how much they'd had to put up with, particularly the two boys.
At school?
At school, mm-hmm.
What did they have to put up with?
The kids taunting them, you know, your dad's over there killing people, your dad, that kind of stuff. And, of course, the thing that was a real killer was that the television every night showing all these dead bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept worried that they'd see their dad in that bunch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
How old were your boys then? Were they in college or high school?
Oh, no, they were in elementary school.
Oh, in elementary school.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's see, Spencer would have been about seven and nine, I guess, and 8 and 10, in that range.
Okay. Okay. How about your wife? What kind of trouble did she encounter?
Oh, she mostly encountered it in stores when people would find out. The kind of thing she'd hear when for whatever reason, it would become known that her husband was in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
someone would have a comment about, well, you know, what's he doing over there?
Mm-hmm.
She had real good support at the church that she was attending,
mm-hmm.
and she had real good support from the military friends in the area,
mm-hmm.
and most of the neighbors around her were supportive.
Okay.
But you always had these people that, for whatever the reason might be, realized you were military,
mm-hmm.
and started talking, you know, about the military being a bunch of bad guys.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But like I had said earlier, she's a military wife, and a good military wife can handle anything. Else they wouldn't last.
Right. I guess that's true. How much were you aware of what was happening back in the United States when you were over in Vietnam, concerning politics, the anti-war protests, just all that stuff that was happening in the late 60s?
Well, during the time I was over there, most of what I got was through news magazines. See, we get Newsweek and Time and all those magazines over there. So we could, if you want to take time to read them, you could pretty well stay on top of what the media was saying anyway.
Okay.
And we did get, commander's call updates and things like that,
mm-hmm.
In the base theater periodically to let us know what they had to tell us.
Mm-hmm.
And we got the, my gosh, I can't remember, the Armed Forces newspaper.
Stars and Stripes?
Stars and Stripes. Okay. We got the Stars and Stripes just about every day. I don't know that. I think they pretty well reported AP and the other people. So we were getting. We were not in a vacuum.
Right. Okay. What did you think of the media's coverage of the war?
Well, it seemed to me that they were biased toward the end. I'm not sure about the beginning. I didn't see as much of it at the beginning, but. The real problem with it is that they made it so live for the American people.
Mm-hmm.
Wars have always been like that. They've been gory and bloody, and people are getting killed.
Mm-hmm.
But reading in the newspaper that some people got killed and seeing them getting killed on television is two different things.
Yes, sir.
Look out for the next one. We see right now how things explode when the media gets it so quickly in our World Trade Center affair,
mm-hmm.
and more recently right here in Washington with the snipers
mm-hmm.
that's been going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like the media takes charge at times.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't particularly say that shouldn't happen because we need that fourth estate
mm-hmm.
to make our democracy work.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes you want to choke a few of them.
I understand.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a couple of general questions about Vietnam. What was your impression of the country when you first arrived there?
Well, it was very different from the impression I left with because, if you noted in the stuff I sent you, I arrived there about a month before or a month and a half before the Tet Offensive began.
Yes, sir.
And all the air crews were being housed at a hotel downtown. Our meals were being served in the dining room. We had laundry service, and it was really pretty nice way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Tet Offensive, they had to pull us all back on base,
mm-hmm.
The air crew members anyway, to have us readily available and not stuck downtown when they need us.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of ended my contact with the Vietnamese people for the most part. I don't think I mentioned in the notes I gave you that when the Tet Offensive first began,
mm-hmm.
I had a chance to help defend that hotel I was in.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. What happened?
Well, the Viet Cong moved in and actually were all around us shooting at the hotel, and they had got into the lower level, and we had Vietnamese militia-type guards. So we had to get shotguns with them.
Okay.
And I didn't do any shooting. I was up on the roof just watching it all.
Mm-hmm.
But they, excuse me, I'm choking up here.
Okay.
I should have sucked a cough drop while we were stopped. let me get a sip of coffee here.
Okay.
Yeah, I had a little fun. I had my camera with me, and I had my tape recorder with me, so I got up on the roof of the hotel while this shooting was going on, and was taping the sounds and shooting pictures of it. I brought that back with me when I came on leave to my family, show it to them. I don't know. I may have that somewhere around here. I think I kept the tape.
Mm-hmm.
It was on an old 2.5-inch reel.
Okay.
But anyway, that was an aside. We had to move back on base, and what the Air Force did, they brought in a bunch of these little modular trailer units where they can have a room in each end of it with a bathroom and an air conditioner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the air crew was staying.
So you had pretty nice private quarters.
Yeah, I had a little cubicle about maybe 10 by 10
mm-hmm.
and a bathroom, but it was certainly inadequate. And being air conditioned and being separate like that, it was quiet so you could sleep during the day.
Mm-hmm.
That was why they had to do it. They had to have something that when you're on that rotating shift that you could get your crew rest.
Mm-hmm. Right. How much contact did you have with the Vietnamese civilians?
Well, very little after that Tet Offensive began, because we were restricted to the post. And the only civilians you see there are the ones that were working there that had been vetted and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So I had not much contact after that.
Okay.
The little bit of contact I had, I thought they were pretty nice people.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the Vietnamese that I've met since then,
mm-hmm.
who of course are over here,
mm-hmm.
Have been very fine people.
Okay. Let's talk about the Tet Offensive. What was your experience with that? You've already described your initial experience with it, but what happened out at Tonsonut and you're out there?
Well, once they managed to get a convoy in and got us out of the hotel and got us back on base.
How long were you there at the hotel waiting?
Oh, just a day.
Okay.
A day and a half, I guess.
Uh-huh.
They got in pretty quick with it.
Okay.
They needed us down there to fly, so they had to come and get us.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suppose it probably may well have been the next morning when I was my crew time had one of those 2 o'clock in the morning goes.
Mm-hmm.
And we were about halfway through our pre-flight getting the thing ready to go when the Viet Cong attacked the airfield, Tonsonut.
Okay.
And they came in big time with rockets, machine guns, and airplanes were easy targets. They were just lined up, both fighters and cargo. And pretty soon they had airplanes burning everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Were you actually in your plane, or were you?
We were at the plane and out on the ramp by each airplane.
Mm-hmm.
They had a small sandbag type dugout sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when the first rocket hit, I called for the crew to get in the sandbag.
Mm-hmm.
So they. I was in the cockpit with the co-pilot and the engineer. We scrambled down and got in, and the
mm-hmm.
Loadmaster came around and got in. There's four of us.
Mm-hmm.
Five of us, I guess. Yeah, five of us. No, five of us. Navigator, pilot, co-pilot, engineer, navigator, loadmaster.
Okay.
And for about 30 minutes, we took a continuous barrage of these rockets coming in, spattering places all over.
Mm-hmm.
And the airplanes were beginning to burn up and down there. And the rocket then had become less intense. So I suggested to the crew that we, since we were out there,
mm-hmm.
that we try to get some of the airplanes that had not caught fire yet and pull them off the line and move them down in a dark area down the line on a taxiway to try to keep them from burning. So that's what we did. I think I took the loadmaster with me, and the co-pilot took the flight engineer, and the navigator went with one of the other of us.
Okay.
But anyway, we moved the airplanes. My memory's not all that good anymore, but we moved several airplanes that were sitting between burning airplanes, you might say, and got them out of the way.
Right.
And in the process of doing that, we discovered some people who'd been injured by the shrapnel and stuff. So we took a pickup truck that had been left there by somebody when it started, loaded those guys up, and three or four of them, and hauled them over to the base hospital. And then we got back down to our dugout at the flight line.
Okay.
About daybreak. But it was a pretty interesting night.
Did you have any weapons with you?
Oh, we had our .38s, revolvers.
Okay.
Ones we normally had when we were flying.
Okay. So that was basically, after that night was over, how soon did things return to normal operations there at Tunsinet?
Well, by noon the next day, the troops had pushed the Viet Cong back off the airfield and got them back out of far enough out they couldn't lay rockets down on it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then the big thing was the cleanup. You know, it was really a mess. But within a day or two, we were flying again with the airplanes that we had. We were pretty severely crippled by lack of planes. Of course, what they did, they flew other airplanes in from Mactan and Okinawa and what have you to replace the ones that couldn't fly.
Mm-hmm. After Tet, did your frequency of missions increase?
Oh, I'm trying to remember if we brought in any more. I don't recall that we actually brought in any more air crews than we'd been bringing in. I think what we saw was a diversion of the use of them, different uses of them.
Right. What was that?
They just prioritized the flights to back up the need for moving troops and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Less cargo and more troop movements, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a tremendous capability build up over there.
Yes.
With all the C-130s and the C-123s.
Mm-hmm.
And we move a lot of people around.
Mm-hmm. What were your general impressions of the enemy, of the Viet Cong and of the NVA?
Well, I had respect for their fighting abilities. You had to see what they were doing against the odds they were working against, you know. But I don't have any first-hand experience to evaluate, you know, how well they were trained or anything else. I didn't ever have to work at that level. I did get out in the field some for about 2 months, I guess, when I took an assignment as a forward airlift commander toward the end of my year over there. And I was working with a team of communications team of the Air Force Blue Berets. We had a couple of Jeeps and about six of those guys, and we would go into, let's say there were going to be a big movement of troops from one point to another point. We would go into the point where they were coming and act as the air traffic controller.
Okay.
For bringing the airplanes in and making sure they unloaded as quick as they could and got back off to make room for the others to come in, type thing.
Okay.
And I'm bounced around to two or three spaces out in the field with that, and that was kind of interesting. It was also, you had to really be watching, because by then you were out there where you could step on a landmine or or all kind of things. So I had to let those boys tell me how to do it. They were trained in that, and I wasn't.
Uh-huh.
But that was an interesting part, but they pulled me back in after about three assignments or four assignments on that, and gave me a job right there at Thompson Newt as a coordinator, I guess you'd call it, between the 824th Air Division and the our 774th. The 824th Air Division was running everything in Vietnam, and our tactical airlift wing was furnishing the material, so there had to be somebody on site that coordinated the scheduling and the requirements and that kind of thing. So, they, again, being a lieutenant colonel with now eight months or so experience there, they gave me that job. That was kind of interesting.
Now, did you volunteer to take the field job to go out there, or did they assign you to that job?
Oh, yeah, I didn't have to take it, but I was asked if I'd go, and I said, sure. Yeah, that's one more way to see what it's like.
Mm-hmm. Anything really memorable happen when you're out in the field, do you remember?
Oh, well, I was up at, I'm trying to remember the name of the, there was a little site we were on moving a bunch of Marines in, right up against the North Vietnamese border, about 3 or 4 miles south of the border. It was up there about 5 days, and we took fire every night. You were sleeping in a little shack type thing, and right by your cot, you could roll out right into a trench alongside of it.
Gosh.
And we brought in a lot of troops up there on the movement, and then we moved on somewhere else.
Okay.
But we were taking rocket fire from some guys out in the boondocks there.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No.
When you were flying some of these resupply missions and picking people up and doing things, did you pick up KIAs?
Yeah, that was you're always your priority. Any mission you were on, if you had combat breakout and they had severely wounded or wounded people, when they called, you would be aborted from what you were doing to go take care of that.
Okay.
Yeah, I remember one night I was pretty far north, and I had actually delivered the stuff I took up and was just about empty, coming back down, and got a call to go into a firefight and pick up some wounded and get them down to, I guess it was Da Nang or Nha Trang, one or the other, where they could be transported by helicopter out to the Navy hospital ship.
Mm-hmm.
So we pitched and went in. It was one of these little strips that was lighted with flare pots. And not your favorite landing place. But we went in and got on the ground, and we just shut down one engine. We didn't shut down any engines. We just shut them all the way back and dropped it back in.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought in 3 or 4 guys in body bags, and then 4 or 5 more that were pretty severely wounded. We got them strapped into litters.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got on the ground, my loadmaster and engineer had already rigged back in to take wounded. You know, they had the litters down, the straps ready. Everything in place. They walked them in, laid them in there. They strapped them, and we were pulled up the door, and we were rolling, getting out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And took them on over to and dropped them off. And when I rolled out at the end of the runway and turned, they had me stop and dropped the door, and a helicopter pitched right behind me and picked these guys up.
Mm-hmm.
From the time they were wounded to the time they were in that hospital offshore, couldn't have been more than an hour and 10 minutes.
Wow. Very efficient.
Yeah.
How did you feel carrying those the wounded in the body bags?
Well, you know, you don't feel good about it.
Right.
But it's a consequence.
Mm-hmm.
And you're glad it's not you, I guess, mm-hmm. even though you don't want to say that.
Mm-hmm.
That feeling always crosses your mind.
Mm-hmm. Going back to your life at Thompson, did you feel like you had enough supplies there, food, anything you would need for everyday life?
Oh, yeah. But, see, by the time I went over there, Rich, in 68,
mm-hmm.
late 67, 68. This war had been going on for a long time.
Yes, sir.
And they had hauled a lot of stuff in. Whatever mistakes came out early on had been pretty well fixed, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was all running, I thought, real good.
Mm-hmm.
Some little sidelights about it, nice things that happened. There were at least two, maybe three times I went over to Officers Club for dinner, and
mm-hmm.
I'm sitting there with my navigator and my co-pilot getting their meal, and mm-hmm. old Tex Ritter ambles up.
Really?
And pulls up a chair and says, "How's it going, boys?" And he was my favorite. We had these guys, a lot of them would come over there and just spend a week or 10 days. And
mm-hmm.
so sometimes they would make arrangements to get on an airplane, fly out, and talk to the boys out in the boondocks.
Mm-hmm.
But I've thought highly of that man ever since. Yeah.
What kind of what did you guys do for entertainment? Do you have USO shows?
Well, the USO shows that they had, if they had them at Thompson Newton, always came when I was up in the air or somewhere else, I guess. I never caught one there.
Uh-huh.
But we did, we delivered these people all over Vietnam to give their shows.
Okay.
They would fly in there, and we'd pick them up and haul them up to Nha Trang or Da Nang or one of the other fairly good-sized bases where they could do their show, and they would do it. And
Remember any of the people? Anybody come to mind that you remember taking around?
Welch, the lady with the...
Raquel Welch?
Raquel Welch, yeah. We took Raquel Welch up one time. And
did she sit up near you guys, or did she stay back in the back?
She sit anywhere she wanted.
Did you fight over where you wanted
to? Actually, that happened to be the day I was putting the people on the airplanes when the other guys got the flyer. I did get to escort her out and get her on it.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, Bob Hope was over there, but I never did see him, but he came through during that time.
Mm-hmm.
The troopers came in to play for the troops.
Right.
And Johnson came in. That was a big command performance.
Mm-hmm.
He came into Da Nang, I guess that was our biggest strip over there.
Mm-hmm.
We had to fly people in from all over South Vietnam so he'd have a big crowd.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I brought a C-130 load up somewhere and set up after the speech was over and then load them up and took them back.
Did you get to listen to the speech?
Nope.
Did you guys fly anywhere else in the Southeast Asian theater besides Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. I flew a few missions up to Korea, several to Japan, Okinawa, Thailand. We were in and out of Thailand fairly often. We didn't go into Cambodia. We'd overfly it occasionally, but I didn't ever go into Cambodia.
Did you ever fly Laos occasionally? I guess
no.
Going over to Thailand? Did you?
Never went into Laos or Cambodia.
Okay. What experience did you have with Arvin or with any of the native or the indigenous forces that we were training and supporting there?
Oh, in my case, just about none.
Right.
We had no training requirement living on to work with them.
Right. Okay.
It was strictly being done by the training teams that were sent over there for that purpose.
What did you hear anything? Any rumors? Any scuttlebutt about the South Vietnamese military?
Well, most of the things we heard was that they trained out pretty well and what have you,
mm-hmm.
which amazed me when we left at how quickly they folded, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think of your overall leadership in Vietnam? Not yours personally, but your immediate supervisors and then overall?
I was pretty well satisfied with it. I thought they... did a good job. They kept us well informed of what we were trying to accomplish and
mm-hmm.
and how we were trying to do it and made sure we had the resources to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I had no complaint in that direction.
Okay. Did you witness any alcohol or drug abuse? I guess, alcohol is a drug, but did you see any of this?
You know, like everybody else, I've read all these stories about
mm-hmm.
how the troops got into it, but I'll tell you what's the gospel truth. I didn't see it in the Air Force units that I was around over there. Mm-hmm. And I think that the reason is that we were not stuck there like the GIs were.
Right.
We were in and out, and we did our 16 days. We went back to the Philippines. We had a nice little officers club, nice little enlisted club, and mm-hmm. and the guys could sit around and have a few beers, and then they go in again, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think the attraction of the drugs was just not as much there for the guys in the Air Force as it was for the people who had to be out there in the bushes.
Did you ever encounter any racial issues there?
No, none at all. I had a African-American navigator for a good while. He was really good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But no problems?
No. At one time or another, had black loadmasters and what have you that were working with me.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys were all professionals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you ever have any exposure, or were you ever around Agent Orange?
Well, I'm sure I was around it because I'd landed on the airbase where it was being flown from mm-hmm. several times, and on occasion would walk over to take a look, see what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I had a little few minutes between flights.
Mm-hmm.
I did not fly or spray it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you may have noted in the things I sent you that I've been involved in the Air Force's 20-year health study.
Yes, sir.
That following up on that. And by the way, I'm going out in the end of January for the 20th and final session on that,
okay.
20th year and final session.
Okay.
To Scripps Clinic in La Jolla, California.
Okay.
Up to now, it appears, anyway, that the Air Force people who were involved in working with the Agent Orange, for the most part, have not suffered any great problems with it, but there has been a definite link established to what we would call adult-onset diabetes.
Okay.
But most of the other things that have troubled the ground troops didn't happen to the Air Force people because when they went to work in the morning
mm-hmm.
and worked with that stuff, when they went home that afternoon, they had a shower.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't have to leave it on them.
Right.
And because they were working with it, they were more aware of the hazards of it and were more careful about handling
it. Right.
But it's poor GIs that got it sprayed on them out in the field. And then walked through the bushes that had been sprayed with it,
mm-hmm.
and then tried to take a bath in the stream that had been sprayed with it.
Mm-hmm.
They have a different problem.
Yeah, that is a different problem. What would you consider was the bravest action that you witnessed while you were in Vietnam?
I think probably the bravest action that I know of from the, and I'm looking at the flying people with this,
mm-hmm.
would be two or three of our guys that literally landed with stuff exploding around them to pick up GIs who were trapped and get them out.
Mm-hmm.
And I have no idea how many times that happened, but quite often. But in only one case am I aware that the air crew got killed trying to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And he landed and got his load on, which was about two-thirds Vietnamese with a few Americans,
mm-hmm.
and just at liftoff, took a direct hit, apparently, with a rocket, and just balled up.
Hmm.
And another one, this one was not necessarily, I guess, the bravest thing, but a friend of mine died on a run down the Oshaw Valley,
mm-hmm.
not too far ahead of me.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a load of ammunition on board.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, he got his rear door down and was on his final approach in to drop the stuff out,
mm-hmm.
and he was hit by machine guns, I gather, from what little bit they could figure out,
mm-hmm.
and it messed up his elevator so that he could not bring the nose of the airplane up,
mm-hmm.
and so it just kept flying until it went in the jungle. We flew right over the drop zone, at about 150 feet and into the jungle beyond it.
Wow.
And he had, I think, two French newspaper reporters on board with him.
Oh, wow.
And that is...
Okay. Looking back at your Vietnam experience, is there anything that you would change about it today?
There's nothing that I personally would change about the way mine went. I think that it was a difficult assignment in some ways, but I was doing my duty for my country as it was said at the time, you know, and that's what I was in the military for. It was my career, and I personally think that I did a good job for them over there, and have nothing there to apologize for. Or maybe nothing to brag about either. But
well, I mean, you underwent quite a bit there.
Yeah.
How did you get your orders to leave Vietnam? Your one-year tour was up, and you...
Well, I was over, you know, I was telling you about being over there at the end of my tour as the liaison officer, coordinating officer.
Yes, sir.
Between the my group and the 824th Air Division.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're always indispensable, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you noted, I went over in November, and I left at the end of December to come back.
Yes, sir.
And I began to question the fact that I didn't think I was all that indispensable. And then, particularly since I wanted to be home for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
So the wing commander says, you know, we got to get you out of here. So he did.
Do you remember your flight out of country? How did you feel when we actually left Vietnam, the ground and airspace?
Well, I felt pretty good about it. I flew the airplane back.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I told them I wanted one last flight, so they let me bring, you know, the aircraft commander with me.
Mm-hmm.
Let me fly it back out.
Mm-hmm.
And landed it at Clark Field in the Philippines. We had been moved from Mactan to Clark by then.
Mm-hmm.
Walked off the airplane, and I was pretty sure from what I'd been told that that would be the last flight I'd ever make in the Air Force, so that's why I wanted to do it.
Really?
I came back to the Pentagon and assigned in the Foreign Military Training Division there as an officer on the staff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many Air Force officers in the Pentagon that only about 10% of them are allowed to continue flying. That, you know, they don't have the resources,
right,
to let you keep flying.
Right.
And so about the first thing I learned when I checked in was that I was grounded.
Okay. How'd you feel about that?
Well, the first thing I wanted to know is, am I still going to get my money? They said, oh, yeah, your flight, you're technically you're not grounded. You're just... Not, they had a term for it that I don't even remember now, but you're not grounded, but you're not going to fly airplanes, but we're going to keep on paying you.
Okay. That's a good deal, I guess.
So I couldn't argue with that.
Right.
So.
Did you have any problems transitioning back into, you didn't go right back to civilian life, but did you have problems transitioning back from Vietnam to the United States?
No. My work at the Pentagon was in many ways a continuation of what I'd been doing over there, because we were doing all the planning and what have you for the training of the Vietnamese Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And I teamed up with Don Kreckelberg on that one.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked it. We were back over there a time or two, you know, coordinating after that.
Mm-hmm.
Over the next 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the whole thing went down to tubes, Don called me. He had retired and was down in Alabama then.
Mm-hmm.
And I had retired and was teaching in the public schools here in Fairfax County,
mm-hmm.
teaching world history and world geography. Any surprise? And anyway, he called up and he says, Myron, you listening to the news? I said, yeah, Don.
Is this April 75?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I says, oh, this doesn't sound like we did a very good job, does it? He says, I'll tell you, it really hurts to see all the work we put in that go down the tubes. Because we had a lot of the planning and what have you effort for the get that Vietnamese Air Force on its own when we pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's the way it went. And then I have to say that when I came back, I sort of put all of this behind me and put it out of my mind, to tell you the truth, Rich. Mm-hmm. And in order to, I had to really go back and do a lot of research just to fill out that questionnaire that we've been working from here. Mm-hmm. And get it all together, dates, times, places, names. I had pushed it out. And it was much the same as I tried to do Labrador.
Right.
Yeah, but I'm not one that tends to have nightmares about things like that and what have you. So, and I rate my career in the Air Force as the best thing could ever happen to me.
I was going to ask you about that. Your decision way back and when you finished your maritime duties and you got into the Air Force, it sounds like you've had a very productive and full career.
Yeah. This will probably cap that for you. My wife and I moved into this place we are now here called Falcon's Landing in 96, right around my 70th birthday. And this is a retirement community, about 450 of us, of all retired military officers from all services.
Wow. Okay.
And it's been fantastic to get back with all these guys. We got everything from a four-star general down to a few majors. But it's a great community to live in, and we're really having a nice older late life experience here.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. That's wonderful to hear.
Yeah. So I just turned 76 last month.
Wow.
So I've got a lot of to look back from.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. What are your perceptions of Vietnam today? When you hear about the country, see the country on the news,
I think it's just waiting to be opened, and I don't know why we aren't pushing a little more to do that than we seem to be.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a golden opportunity to me right now to go in and get the country turned around and more on the road to a more democratic form of government than they have. They're a bright people. They're a nice-looking people, and it's just a shame that more can't be done for them. The Vietnamese that have migrated over here that I've had contact with in the school system, and I taught for 4 years and became a guidance counselor for another 14 or 15 before I retired completely.
Okay.
And my Vietnamese students, by and large, were terrific.
Okay.
And with that kind of raw material to work with, it's a shame that we can't get that place opened up to where their educational system will be better than it appears to be anyway, and give them a chance. China's breaking out now. Maybe we ought to try to help Vietnam break out.
What do you think about the United States policy toward Vietnam, looking back at it over in retrospective?
You mean following the end of the the war?
Yes, sir. Just kind of looking at it in general, what are your overall impressions of it?
Well, I think we did what we had to do for the first 10, 15 years anyway, you know, with the POW problems that were there and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, look at how we handled Europe when World War II was over.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, I see that kind of approach as the way to try to do it. It took a long time for Russia to come around, but it looks like maybe they're coming now.
Have you read any good books on Vietnam that you would recommend to people that you find authentic or worthy of people reading?
I really haven't.
Okay. How about movies? Some of these movies that have been coming out on the war. I mean, starting back in 79 with Apocalypse Now, coming all the way to We Were Soldiers, which came out just this past year.
I haven't seen We're the Soldiers yet. I guess I'll have to get to see that one. We have movies here at the community every Wednesday night, and I'll put that one on the list to bring in.
Okay, all right. It's We Were Soldiers is
mm-hmm.
the name of it.
I've seen the advertisements and the write-ups on it.
Mm-hmm. No other movies about Vietnam stick out in your mind?
Well, the one about the riverboats in Vietnam, the Navy riverboats.
Okay. Was that Apocalypse Now?
Yeah.
And the guy was going up the river?
Yeah. That one I did see, and I was intrigued with it, and particularly now since Senator Kerry has got his problems with it, and Admiral Zumwalt's son supposedly died from Agent Orange that he got on the river.
Yes, sir.
But that's it. Like I say, I kind of put it behind me. I didn't go looking.
Right.
You know, once Vietnam fell, I was crushed, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Are there any songs that, when you hear on the radio today, remind you of your time in Vietnam?
Oh, yes. At our little officers club at Mac Tan Island, mm-hmm. We had Filipino music groups come by two or three nights a week to play for us.
Mm-hmm.
And one particular group, trio with a young lady, appeared to be about 18, 20 years old, would I especially like, but she could come in and sing that song, Strangers in the Night, and I could just sit there and shiver. But the Filipino people are especially talented in music, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They had some of the best groups. We had a large number of them were imported into Vietnam to play for us over there in our officers' clubs and that kind of thing.
Right.
They were really good.
Okay. Would you ever want to go back to Vietnam to see it?
Oh, I haven't had any great desire to go back. My wife and I both have wanted to travel since we got out of service, and we've done all over Europe and the Mediterranean. We've traveled some in Central South America a little bit, and a lot of, but we've never had much of an inclination to go to the Far East.
Okay.
Going to Honolulu in February.
Okay, getting closer. What kind of lessons do you think the United States learned from Vietnam?
Well, I think we've learned that you better marshal your resources and apply them when you're going into one of these things, or else you better not go. And that's, we saw that in the Gulf War. It worked like a jewel.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got to see how well they're doing it with Iraq, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of the piecemeal build up, add a little more pressure, and then if that doesn't work, add a little more pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't work worth a damn over there.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, I just felt like we never really went in there to win the war. We had the means and the asset to end that war almost from day one, and we just didn't use it.
Why do you think we didn't use it?
Oh, well, Johnson, being a good politician, wanted guns and butter both, I guess. And didn't seem willing to bring on the sacrifice it would have taken to get on with it and get it over with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's just the feeling I have.
Okay. Okay.
So,
what do you think the most significant thing was that you learned while in Vietnam? Or is there something that sticks out in your mind that you personally learned while there?
Oh, I can't put a finger on any significant thing that I learned there other than, be alert and be careful.
Okay. If you were walking to a classroom today, a college classroom or a high school classroom, and you were to have to tell young people today about Vietnam, what would you tell them?
I think about the best I can do is what I've been doing with you here today is tell them about my experiences and then try to draw a conclusion from that. I think that Vietnam could be a self-sufficient and productive country from what I could see there. They have a climate that will permit agriculture. They have a land that will support agriculture. They certainly have, if they wanted to try to get in the tourist business, have the natural attractions in terms of their beaches and their mountains. Why these things haven't developed, I don't know.
Okay.
But you know what?
What's that?
I was down in Belize last week on a cruise with my wife, and Belize is in worse shape than Vietnam.
Really?
And it's a small little country, but it's poor. I mean, gee, it's poor. So I guess there's a lot of places in the world like that. But Belize is going to develop because they've opened up to tourism now. make an arrangement to handle as many cruise ships as will come bring money.
Right.
And it's such a small country, that's going to have a huge impact for them because I think the brochure down I picked up down there said there were only 270,000 people in the country.
Oh. Okay. Well, sir, is there anything else you'd like to add to this interview or anything you feel like you want to say?
I think not. Okay. If someone is listening to this 20 years from now, I want them to know that the Americans that I knew in Vietnam were all serious about doing their job and doing it well. Mm-hmm. And I know we've had stories about the fragging of the officers and what have you and some of the other services, but I didn't see any of that.
Okay.
And that the guys I dealt with were all very professional and competent.
Okay.
And that's about as much as I can say about it, I guess.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir. We'll end the interview now.